This is The Pulse. I'm Bharati Jagdish. Now, the transport scene continues to see changes, with HDT Singapore Taxi announcing just earlier this week that it's received a taxi service operator license, making it the country's seventh operator. The company was given a full-fledged 10-year license. It will operate at least 800 electric taxis. Recently, we also saw MVL enter the private hire car service market with its app, Tada. And among its selling points is that it will not collect commission fees from drivers using its platform, it will keep fares competitive, and not even levy cancellation penalties on riders. Now, all this sounds very attractive, but it also comes soon after complaints from commuters that Grab Singapore seemed to have scaled back on its rewards and benefits for consumers after its merger with Uber. Consumers have been asking for more competition in the market so that we can get more competitive prices. But is that really the way to go? And are the conditions right for this in the long term? Uber came in and clearly couldn't survive, hence the merger with Grab. In the bike-sharing sector, of course, there's the case of O-Bike suddenly exiting Singapore and taking our deposits with them. How friendly exactly should Singapore be to such startups? How can the market find an equilibrium? Joining me today to talk about this, transport economist Walter Tessera from the Singapore University of Social Sciences and Jamie Ho, chief editor of Channel News Asia's Digital News Desk. So, Walter, first of all, with the latest taxi operator in the market, with a new player in the private hire car sector, what sort of impact do you expect all of this to make?
Well, I think, honestly, in the near to medium term, I don't think there'll be a really a significant impact to the commuter experience where private hire and taxis are concerned. And, you know, the reason why I mentioned that is a lot of the new ideas or the new entrants we've seen, particularly in the private hire space, I feel that there's a fundamental misunderstanding here of the basic economics of the industry. People have been coming in with what they perceive to be or what they argue to be superior business ideas. You know, For example, using blockchain or charging no commissions or things of that sort. But what they, I think, don't understand is in this kind of market, it's really winner takes all. And what you really need to do to succeed in this market is have enough cash to basically build a commanding position, a commanding market share. And once you have that, you can deliver superior service to commuters and you can give good earnings to drivers.
But
and
at higher prices. But yeah, at higher correct, prices correct. For commuters. Because isn't that kind of what Grab has done?
Well, I think part of the problem, of course, with Grab and Uber before them is that in their rush to gain market share, they threw so much money at the market, they subsidized drivers and commuters to such a large extent that I really don't think we know what the real price is of delivering this service anymore. I mean, if you look around the world, historically, taxi companies don't make huge profits. This is not a high-margin business. People might complain and think or argue taxi prices are very high, but actually, it's really not a high-margin business. And so, the fact that we've been led to believe that you can have this kind of point-to-point service for very low prices, conveniently, this is unrealistic.
And it's created an artificial demand that, frankly, if you ask me, isn't doing much for our car-light vision in the long term. But these unsustainable business models, here to stay? Or is it time for them to rethink all of this? Jamie, maybe you could jump in here.
No, I think, as Walter suggested, the entire premise of some of these new entrants and business models is precisely not one that allows for many players in any particular industry, but really one or two dominant players in a winner-takes-all situation. The key thing is actually, I would look at it, is what the role of the consumer and employee in a larger economy where there is just so much churn as well. Whether it is, as you said, the private car hire or is it the shared bikes, all these industries, actually, what's going to be characteristic of them and other new things is the amount of churn. Churn in terms of new entrants, people falling out, and what happens to consumers and employees of these companies in the meantime. So I think people need to be a little bit more educated, a little bit more realistic about expectations when they go in, and also expectations of the government in terms of how whether they can even regulate all this. And then at some point, people will realize that this is the nature of the business, that when new entrants come in, again, it's probably not going to be sustainable, as we saw with Grab and Uber and the pricing models. In some of these bike sharing, again, people should have seen that this was not really sustainable. And I think that's going to be the case going forward in many other instances.
I just recently wrote a piece actually about this, saying that consumers just have to enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah, right.
And suck it up when things change. This is the nature of the industry. But Walter, do you see any of these players perhaps taking a different approach in the next few years? Some analysts have suggested they need to rethink their strategies.
Well, I think, you know, one can't really blame the companies and their founders for their current business strategies, because in many cases, I think they're following the dictates of the capital market. And I think the reality is, unfortunately, you know, we've been going through quite a long period, I think, of excess liquidity and worldwide. And there are a lot of investors out there looking for ways to multiply the capital. And, you know, what they're attracted to at the moment is these high growth stories, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, there is a business model which in theory might work, right? For example, you know, for bike sharing, at the end of the day, the idea is if you have enough of the market and people, you know, pay you these deposits, you can, of course, make money off the deposits. You can also make money off the rides. And if you don't lose too much money in operations and vandalism and so on, that might be a profitable business model, right? So what mm-hmm. happens here is, of course, the investors are throwing in money and they're basically saying, you know, if this company grows fast enough, maybe in 1 or 2 years' time, we'll actually start to make money. And I guess the problem here with many of the business models is some of these assumptions are untested, right? So in bike sharing in Singapore and worldwide, certainly, I think the assumption that your costs would be controllable and that you wouldn't have too much vandalism having to replace or move bikes around and things like that, I mean, that is not panned out in many cities worldwide. And that is why they're scaling back their operations now, for example, right? Mm. But I think, you know, it's not, you know, fundamentally, it's not a very different story today than from, I would say, you know, capitalism for the last couple of thousand years, which mm-hmm. is people want to make money. They're attracted to stories about growth. They're willing to risk some money on these investments, and hopefully they get a huge return, right? And I mean, that's not a different story today than it was for the last couple of hundred or thousand years.
You mentioned earlier, though, the end game seems to be to entrench a monopoly.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But is that necessarily beneficial, either to the company, obviously not to the consumers?
Right. No, I agree. I think there is a concern there, because I think many of these business models actually do not work unless the company either is monopoly or has a massive economy of scale due to being the largest player. I mean, that's basically how Amazon works, more or less. It's the largest player in logistics, you know, in many of the markets it operates in. Certainly, that's the story about Grab, right? Or Uber. It's about being the largest player in point-to-point transport services, and then using that, in the case of Grab today, for example, to move into related industries. And I guess the basic idea is, once you're the biggest player, not only is it cheaper for you to serve the market because you have that efficiency, but of course you also have a competitive mode, a fortress. It becomes very hard for people to compete with you, and indeed, that is what all of the small ride-hailing entrants are finding in Singapore. You just really can't compete with a large player. I would say not necessarily because the large player uses any underhanded tactics. It's simply because they have such an economy of scale over you that, you know, you can't really get started. And that's what you're aiming for if you're a company in this market. You're aiming to have that large market share, and therefore to make it hard for people to compete with you.
Under such circumstances, sure, prices might moderate, but to what extent would demand then decrease quite a bit?
And it should. It probably will as well, because in the early stages, I think there was unsustainable demand for some of these services. People were probably taking it when they didn't really need to. If a Grab ride cost you $3 when actually economically maybe it should have cost you $8.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I think, switched from walking or taking the bus
precisely.
To doing this.
So I think
this.
We're going to have to see a little bit of a swing back towards more normal behavior, normal in inverted commas. So I think I wouldn't be so downbeat on what the prospects are for monopoly or one or two big players in some of these sectors. Because I give you an example. Let's say Grab is the big dominant player, and people complain that, oh, you know, we like a bit more competition, this will allow them to charge higher prices. But let's be honest, there are alternatives. They may not be a direct competitor within them in the private car hire space, but we still have our taxis, right? Mm. And we still have a pretty good public transport system. So consumers still do have options. Even in the shared bikes space, yes, if let's say you have the day when there's just one dominant player, we can still regulate our behavior dependent upon that. And we can still make decisions that maybe I don't want to take the bike, maybe I'll walk, maybe I'll take the MRT. So I'm not sure it's that dismal a situation if in some of these specific industries there is just one dominant player. Maybe as Walter suggested, it is meant to have just one player because of the economies of scale.
We have talked a lot about consumers and even the people who work in such industries, but what about the role of regulators? Because some analysts have pointed out that players such as O-Bike and all that should have been scrutinized more before being just invited into the market or let into the market. Mm. Where do you stand on this, Walter?
Well, I think there are several different questions here about regulation. I think one question is about what is the role of regulators when it comes to, for example, the transport industry. And I think there, traditionally, we've seen that the role of the regulator is to protect the consumer, but, you know, to more focus, generally speaking, on protecting consumers against safety risks rather than, you know, just, I mean that's traditionally considered to be quite a bit more important, for example, than the risk of losing your deposit and things of that sort. Okay, I mean, certainly O-Bike has caused a lot of concern, you know, because of the fact that you have a lot of deposits now which appear to be quite difficult to recover. But I have to say here, that's not a transport problem per se. That's a problem that, in fact, plagues many other industries in Singapore. And I think it really comes down to the fact that it's very common in Singapore and many other markets for merchants to require deposits or prepayments in advance. And unfortunately, in Singapore, we do have a lot of well-publicized cases of these merchants then running away with your deposits. Yeah. And I think there's not much that can be done about that except to educate consumers, you know, that they do have to know who they're dealing with, and they have to be aware that really when it comes to small payments, prepayments, things of that sort, even if you have regulation which gives people some kind of guarantee of protection, in practice it's not that easy to actually collect these kinds of small sums, you know.
Of course, some have said, you know, look at the track record of this company, check them out a little bit before opening up the market to them. But would that be, again, like you said, really not the purview of the regulators here?
I think we want to be business friendly in Singapore.
Too business friendly? Are we being too business friendly?
I don't know whether we're too business friendly, but I think what we have to keep in mind is anytime you want to introduce regulations about, for example, funding that new entrants have, you know, capital requirements and so on, they're going to sound good on paper, and indeed it might go some way towards protecting the public. But at the same time, you know, you have some young Singaporean entrepreneur who doesn't have much capital or money and they have a good idea. And the moment you start raising, I think, the bar or the requirements here, you're going to have people, you know, complaining in the opposite side. You know, I have a good business idea, but the government won't let me start up my business. And I think, I mean, to me, I think that's actually probably a larger risk than the problems we're facing right now of some companies not living up to their promises. We don't want to, I think, stifle innovation.
Yeah, you don't want excessive government intervention either. Jamie, where do you stand on this?
If you look at the whole principle of regulation, usually regulation is retroactive in any case, in that the government will come in as and when they see that there is an issue to be addressed. So whether, as Walter said, it's public safety or whatever, that is where it comes in. And in this particular case, because the market is so open, because barriers to entry these days are so low, things happen so quickly, to expect the government to correspondingly react in that kind of retroactive but doubly quick way is firstly unrealistic, and secondly is also probably not something that the government should be doing, if you ask me, in maintaining at least some degree of pro-business position as well, because that's the kind of ecosystem that has to exist. So again, it goes back to, and I agree, Walter, a very, very large degree of consumer education and seeing that this is the new playing field as well. You cannot expect businesses that operated 10, 15 years ago to be as omnipresent or as reliable or as permanent as, you know, they used to be. The times have changed. People will come, people will go. Hopefully those are not the ones that you put your big deposits on as well.
And these are just the perils of a capitalist society that we have to accept.
Yeah, I mean, what's the opposite? I don't think there is an opposite that you want to actually consider, where barriers or regulations or legislation or such are erected so quickly or even pre the emergence of new players. I don't think that that is the situation that we want to be as well.
And the government can't be responsible for stabilizing the industry. You just have to let market forces do the work.
Well, I think to be a bit more clear about what government should or shouldn't do, I think there are some areas where government can step in and maybe could have stepped in a bit earlier. I think when you talk about shared bikes, for example, I think the area which probably causes the largest concern and in fact the largest problem to the public is this issue of indiscriminate parking and the externalities caused by that. The fact that you in some areas you can't walk down a pathway without running into these bikes.
Yeah.
And I think that is quite foreseeable given the experience that other cities with lots of shared bikes face. And I suppose if there is something we were a bit slow in, I think it could be that we were a bit slow in licensing the sector and therefore collecting from the companies enough money to ensure that, for example, if they were to exit suddenly, there would at least be money to pay the people to go around and collect all the bikes and things of that sort. So I think that is just one area. I think the other area comes in the question of market structure and what is an efficient market structure for the industry and what is the role of the government in fostering that. For example, in some industries, it may very well be the case that the efficient market structure is for there to be a very large player or a monopolist. It might be the case for private hire, for example. I don't know whether that's true, but that might be the case. And if it were the case that the appropriate market structure is not, for example, intense competition, but rather a winner-takes-all, then the role of the government as regulator is to ensure that the monopolist doesn't abuse its power, that the prices it does charge are fair in the sense that the monopolist can earn a return on their capital, but not unreasonably so. Right? But
by setting caps and things like that?
Correct. For example, by regulating pricing or by monitoring what it does. But I think the risk here or the problem here is that I don't think we know enough about many of these emerging industries yet to be able to conclude what the best form of regulation is. And that's why it very much is an evolving space. That's why I think the comment has been made indeed that regulation is often retroactive because often the facts about what the most efficient structure is or should be will only become apparent after companies try things out and then you see what happens.
Yeah, precisely. So this was probably exactly what happened in the shared bike space as well, because I don't think when they opened up the space, anyone expected the explosion in the number of players and the number of bikes, how readily available it was. Yep. And
how people would disrespect
it. Exactly, and the public behaviour that would have come after that. Right? I don't think that anybody expected that, whether it was a regulator, the government, or even consumers like us, it was brand new. Now, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, you see the same things happening in other places like Australia and things like that. But now you see the pictures of bikes in bike graveyards, whether it's in Singapore or in China, then you realize, oh my God, right? This was never sustainable and no one expected this. So precisely, I think that there has to be a big dose of realism when it comes to understanding in such a quickly moving space what government can really do in terms of regulation.
Considering the importance of exercising some realism in how we perceive the market, Walter, what do you foresee happening in the transport space today? When can we expect a shakeout? What are the conditions that would lead to an equilibrium of sorts, some stability?
Well, the transport space is a very big question, but I think let's talk about shared bikes first, and then maybe I can talk a bit about private hire and taxis and so on later.
Yeah.
I think in the shared bike space, there is a real question, I think, as to whether the current dockless shared bike model is profitable, is sustainable, and if it's not sustainable, then of course there's a bigger question about whether there should in fact be shared bikes at all. My current belief is that I'm not so sure that a competitive shared bike ecosystem is actually sustainable. I think the companies are going to run each other into the ground, but that doesn't mean that shared bikes should disappear from our transport landscape. I think we may have to look, for example, eventually at a docked bicycle sharing system, which is in fact the system that is used in many Western cities. And we also have to note that that kind of system is often publicly subsidized or it's sponsored by a large corporate. And the reason why why you have to pay for that system if it really doesn't pay for itself, right? But why do you have it? You have it because it provides a very valuable transport option that fills in the first and last mile. So right. That's on bike fitting.
That sounds way more sustainable than what we're seeing now.
Well, it's sustainable, yes and no, right? Because it is sustainable because there's a large public or corporate commitment to it of advertising or of public subsidies, but it's not sustainable in the sense that the users don't pay for it. And then really, why are you having it? You're having it because it's an element of your public transport system. Just like in any public transport system, you don't really expect the users to cover all of the costs with their fares alone. That's the same thing also for a shared bike system. It helps to fill in gaps in the public transport system, and that's why we might want to subsidize it. But yeah, I have some doubts as to whether the competitive free-for-all dockless system can ever make a profit. Because the nature of the business in most cities where it's been tried out is that the companies basically beat each other to death by throwing in more and more bikes into the street, regardless of profitability. And the problem here is even if you have a strong competitor which manages to somehow outmuscle others, as long as their investors are willing to throw money at the problem, it's unlikely that the competitor can ever charge prices which makes the business sustainable. That's why you usually have monopoly docked bike sharing models in many cities throughout the world.
What about in the private hire car and taxi space?
My feeling is this is also an industry where at least for booking systems, private hire booking systems, that also tends towards monopoly or very large player. And again, that's because of the basic economy of scale in the industry. If you have most of the market, you can deliver more rides to consumers more quickly and efficiently, and you can also ensure a better income stream for drivers. And that's why both drivers and commuters tend to flock to one app. Of course, they like to have different apps around for the competition, but they'll probably find on average that the app with the largest market share gives them the most consistent and reliable service. And that's why it tends towards monopoly. You may have small players, but those small players are unlikely to get any traction. And over time, they tend to either get muscled out or get bought up by the bigger players. So, I mean, in this space, I don't expect to see much real shakeup until or if and when Gojek enters. And if Gojek does enter, what I expect to see is a period of maybe, 6 months to a year where you have a lot of intense fighting, and then you have the market settle down again with one of them buying the other out. That's what I expect to happen.
Okay, a cycle, in other words.
Exactly.
That we have been seeing vestiges of as well over the last few years.
And you see the same cycle in other countries where, you have a big player being muscled out and then you have entry occurring again. I mean, we're seeing that in China right now where Uber exited, but then, the market still hasn't consolidated yet.
Anything to add, Jamie?
No, so I heard you
chuckle a little.
Yeah, on the bikes, I mean, precisely. I mean, if you look at places like London, right, they had the dock bikes way ahead of anyone else, and precisely it was seen as a very integral part of their overall transport for London public transport system, and therefore, again, heavily subsidised. But there was one player, and that was the way it was. And I think I agree that probably the issue really probably lies in whether it's a docked or undocked system and how many players there are. So I hopefully it will settle towards that maybe in the near future, because precisely it's not going to be sustainable. But in terms of the shared, the private hire car industry, it's probably going to be a little while more before when you get all this, as I said just now, churn and entry and exit of players before you get into something sustainable. And in the meantime, I always say that consumers still have a choice.
Yeah,
you still have a choice in terms of the taxi services, which are actually getting more reliable as well. It's not as if that sector is stagnant or not moving. So I think if you see in that perspective, it's probably something that will happen in terms of the stabilization, but it's probably not going to happen so soon. But I think consumers still are in all right position.
All right, just beware of the various ups and downs that you're likely to face. Try not to complain too much and take advantage of the fact that you have those choices. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining me today. Transport economist Walter Tessera from the Singapore University of Social Sciences and Jamie Ho, chief editor of Channel News Asia's Digital News Desk. Thanks for joining us on The Pulse.